Good afternoon and welcome to the Risk Margin in Life Insurance session, which is authored by Martin Paino and Brian Cummings. Martin is a partner at KPMG Actuarial and has 15 years' experience in the financial services industry. He has extensive experience in reserving and capital management. In particular, he worked extensively with companies, both large and small, to determine logic risk margins. And he's audited a number of reinsurers and insurers' risk margins. He'll bring that to that experience with today's presentation, but he also, together with Brylan, has conducted a survey of risk margins of the life insurance industry, and he'll share that with you today. Brylan Cummings is a director at KPMG. She has 15 years of experience in various areas, including capital management, experience analysis, and so on. She is also a member of the risk business task force, the capital task force, which has been quoted extensively recently, especially in the last sessions. And she has a long time interest in risk margins and capital. In today's session, Martin will speak for about 5 minutes and introduce the session, and then Brylan will take you through the paper for about 20 minutes, and then we'd like lots of participation, please. So with that, I'd like Martin to come and start the session.
Thanks, Ma. As you all know, from the 1st of January 2013, life insurers need to calculate future stress margins and random stress margins for the purpose of determining regulatory capital requirements. The guidance in the prudential standards around how you determine these margins is largely principles-based and is open to some interpretation issues. So we thought it would be a good idea to survey the industry on how they've determined their risk margins. So we developed a survey. It had two components. The first component had a series of questions, and those questions were focused around trying to understand the methodologies that people use to set their risk margins. And then the second part of the survey was around collecting the random and future stress margins that companies had adopted. We performed the survey in late December through to early February. Over the Christmas break, obviously, some people weren't available, so that's why it spanned that period of time. And we surveyed 17 companies, so we surveyed 11 direct insurers and 6 reinsurers. When we collated all the results together and we had a look at them, there was some interesting results, and I'm not going to go through them all today, but a couple of them are, for example, 14 of the 17 insurers had an insurance risk charge, I should say, in one of their statutory funds. So that meant that obviously for most insurers, the level of their risk margins had some impact on their capital requirements. We also found that there was a wide range of margins. And when we looked at trying to understand why there was such a wide range of margins, we came to the conclusion that there was many factors driving this wide range of margins. Some of them were company specific, so for example, how big the company was, but there seemed to be other reasons that weren't company specific. So for example, how the company was interpreting the prudential standards, the views of the actuary and so forth were all impacting the level of the margins. Given these results, we decided it would be a good idea to write a paper on this topic. So what we've done, we've written a paper. It's on the website. I know most of you won't have seen it because it only went up last night, but I think it's a very good read. And I'm sure that you're going to rush home tonight and you're going to get on the Institute's website and you're going to download it, and hopefully you won't crash the website when you're doing that. That was supposed to be a joke. You're supposed to laugh. Because you're going to be disappointed. There's not going to be any more jokes from here on out. So in terms of the paper, as I said, I think it's a very good read. And the other reason why you should read it is because we're not going to cover off all the topics that we're going to talk. The paper covers off more topics than what we're going to cover today. So that's another reason why you should have a read of it when you get home tonight. Now, in terms of the structure of the presentation, I am going to give you a brief summary of the risk margin survey results focused on future stress margins. And then I'm going to hand over to Brylan, who's going to talk about the following things. She's going to talk about interpretational issues in relation to LPS 115. And then she's going to talk about some insights from the general insurance industry, Solvency II, the Risk Capital Task Force paper, and how these insights can help insurers better set risk margins. This slide summarises the future stress margins adopted by the companies that we surveyed. You can see at the bottom, this works. We've got the group margins down the bottom. We have the retail margins up the top. And this column here, we have the minimum margin. So this is, if you looked across the 17 companies, this is the lowest margin that one of the companies had adopted. And that's for the different the different risks. That's the maximum. That's the average. This is the task force numbers. So that's basically your misestimation of the mean and your trend risk. And if you add those two together, that's those numbers there. And then that's your quiz one margins that APRA outlined in their quiz one technical documents and so forth. So some observations on the results. You can see that the margins for group are higher than retail, which is what you'd expect. That's what APRA suggested in their quiz one paper. You can see that the average is higher than the task force numbers, which is, again, what you'd expect. Basically, these are at 97% confidence level. These are at a 99.5. You need to be a little bit careful just down in here. That's not really a like-for-like comparison, because this is stresses to the incidence and termination rates, while this is stresses to reserves. But the observation that these are heavier than those is true. And then for quiz one, you can see that the average is lower than the quiz one margins across the board there, which is, again, what you would expect. That being the reason being that the quiz one margins reflect, as APRA said, for a small insurer, and the average has obviously got small and large. Now, that's the things that you would think make sense. What was a bit more surprising to us is why we're getting such a wide range here. Why is this range so wide? So I'm now going to hand over to Brylan, who's going to talk about that issue and why that's occurring and so forth.
So to some extent, we were expecting variation in the results because companies are different sizes, they've got different business mixes, they've got different levels of reinsurance. All of these things should drive variation in the margins. As Martin said, though, the variation was very wide. And when we looked at the companies that were and where they were placed, it actually didn't stack up in terms of, you know, companies that you think should have similar margins actually had very wide differences. And so we went back to talk to companies about what their thinking had been when they set the margins, etc. And what we found is that there are a large number of other things driving margins other than those things. And those are interpretation of the standards, differences in methodologies used to determine the margins, and finally, how companies went with their qualitative analysis to get from where they've got some data to reach the 99.5 percentile. In our discussions with capital actuaries, we identified a general theme that some companies were interpreting the standards prescriptively, i.e. adopting a black letter law approach to the standards, and other companies were interpreting them more in a principles-based approach. We then went back and reread the standards and read all the supporting material that APRA had released prior to releasing those final standards. And there is a case for both a prescriptive review and a principles-based view because there's information on both sides. And if you want to have a read of that argument and that information, it's in our paper, but I won't go through it today in the interest of time. What I do want to talk about is the four main areas in which the interpretation differed. Firstly, the types of risks that were covered by future stress. Secondly, the allowance made for the assumption-setting process when setting future margins. Thirdly, the time horizon used when setting the future margins. And fourthly, the allowance for diversification benefits. I'll go through each of these in turn. In our survey, there seemed to be some differences as to what risks companies were actually considering formed part of the future stress. So what we did is we went back to first principles and said, well, what are all the causes of adverse experience? And you can see here there's sort of a whole range there. And this is just our view of all the different causes. You could group them differently, potentially add a few more in, but I think you get the feel. The next step is to say, well, how do those risks map to APRA's categories of future random and event stress? Well, the event risk sort of fairly obviously maps to event stress, as does random. In terms of future stress, probably trend and systemic are the ones which fairly obviously map to the future stress. And then things start getting a bit more tricky. Underwriting and claims management, if you think of unintentional changes to your underwriting claims management process, which is where the process is broken down due to some reason or other, that's potentially falling into your operational stress rather than into any of your into your future. If you think of analysis error and data error, once again, this sort of spans two types of things. Firstly, it can be that you've had a process breakdown, which can lead to those errors and that risk, or it can just be to the fact that your analysis or your data isn't sufficiently detailed or of good enough quality. And so we said, well, where it's a process breakdown, that maybe falls into your operational stress. And where it's a quality issue, maybe that falls into the future stress. Cyclical was an interesting one. And I'll go through sort of our rationale for cyclical in a bit of detail so that you understand what we talk about when we're saying prescriptive versus principles-based. LPS 115 sort of defines future stress as arising from misestimation or adverse trends. When you think about misestimation, adverse trends, it's not clear that cyclical risk is either misestimation or it's an adverse trend, because if you're setting a long-term assumption, cyclical risk just might not play into it due to the fact that it balances out over time. Therefore, a prescriptive-based view says, well, it's not part of my future stress at all because it doesn't fall into either of those components. And if I feel I need to allow for it in terms of capital, I'll do that in my target capital, not in my regulatory capital. The principles-based view, however, said, well, it's a major cause of risk. APRA means us to cover all the major causes of risk, so let's put it in, and the most sensible place for it to go is in the future stress. So what you can see immediately is that you're going to have different levels of risk margins depending upon where companies decided to put their risks, whether they're putting them into the risks, sorry, into the regulatory capital, or where they're saying, no, it's not actually in the standard that it belongs, so we're going to put it in target capital instead. The second interpretive issue relates to the assumption setting process. So APRA in LPS 115 says the future stress margins must allow for the possibility that the best estimate assumptions may need to be changed in 12 months' time. Well, what does that actually mean? As actuaries, when we set our best estimate assumption, we typically smooth experience in over time, and this was talked about in one of the panel sessions yesterday. And that means that even if I had a really high experience next year, and it was actually going to be an ongoing high experience, when I set my assumption at the end of next year in my best estimate normal process, I would not have allowed for that full increase because I would have said, I don't know that it's going to stay there, I'm going to smooth it in over time. And that's sort of the prescriptive-based view of the standard, is that you allow for the fact you're going to smooth experience in. Alternatively, some companies have adopted the process, the idea that when you're setting these assumptions for the purpose of capital, you should instead adopt a more purist view and say, well, I'm going to imagine this is in a perfect world. And in a perfect world, if I had the increase in experience next year and it was going to be ongoing, I would know that. And therefore, I will allow for the full impact when I set my assumption next year. So you can see that from this one, you're also going to get a significant difference in the level of the risk margin, depending on whether you're going to smooth that adverse experience in over time or whether you instead go for the one-hit approach because you've got a perfect view of what your experience is. The third interpretive issue is the time horizon adopted for the assumption. So your best estimate assumption, once again, is typically, well, it's a long-term assumption. It should ideally reflect the full duration of your liabilities. But in reality, probably people set it somewhere between 5 and 10 years in terms of time horizon, given that they have the ability to change things and 20 years away and guessing what mortality might be doing then is actually a long time away. So that's one view, and it's probably what the prescriptive view is, to say, well, where might my best estimate assumption go? I should adopt that long-term time horizon. Alternatively, the principles-based views are sort of split into two categories. The first one says, well, if I'm in a situation where my termination value is greater than my stress liabilities in a year's time, then I should actually adopt a time horizon of 12 months to be consistent with that scenario for the LPS 115 as a whole. The other view is to say, well, let's not take quite so broad a view. Let's just have a look at the future stress in and of itself, and I can allow for management actions. And one of the key management actions is, of course, repricing, where companies often say in 3 to 5 years' time, I'll reprice. So in that situation, you might adopt a time horizon of 3 to 5 years to reflect that those management actions and repricing is going to come into effect. All of that changes what your level of risk margin is for those causes of risk that we identified. To just go through a couple, cyclical, you can see that if you've adopted a long-term time horizon, that cyclical gets averaged out, so your cyclical risk is going to be very low, versus if you've adopted a very short time horizon, the cyclical risk suddenly becomes very important in terms of what your experience might be and what that assumption might look like. I'm going to go through an example of AIDS, when AIDS came into the US, to give you an example of how the time horizon changes. So in 1981, there was the first instance of HIV/AIDS recorded. And if you were at that point in time, you might have said, well, what might my assumption look like? So in 1981, it emerged. By 1982, so the 12-month time horizon, there had been 177 deaths across the USA. So you can see that from an insurance perspective, your risk or adverse experience virtually unchanged over the period of a year. If we look to 5 years' time, so 1986 now, insurance companies were experiencing increased rates of mortality between 0.5% and 4%. And the reason why you had those differences is that depend upon where you were sourcing your business geographically. So companies that had a lot of business on the East Coast were kind of having higher margins than companies that were sourcing all their business from the Midwest, say. And if you're adopting this approach, you might say, well, a stress margin of 2% over a period of 5 years is relevant. If you're adopting a longer time horizon, mortality continued to worsen from that point. And in 1988, companies were thinking that they might have to double their mortality rates or worse to allow for AIDS. By the time you get to 1995, you get the medical breakthrough happening, and suddenly mortality rates plummeted overnight due to AIDS. So here you can see very clearly time horizon really important for this sort of a systemic risk event. Diversification. The standard specifically talks about diversification between event risk, random risk, and future stress. We've then got further levels where we might want to consider diversification, specifically between the morbidity products, so between trauma, TPD, and income protection, between the reserves, active lives, IBNR, etc., and also between the causes of the risk if you're going to do it at a lower level and look at these trend risks, cyclical risks, etc., individually. When we surveyed the companies, most companies actually didn't allow for any diversification beyond what APRA specified. 6 allowed for diversification between the morbidity products out of the 17 companies, and only 5 for diversification between reserves. So we don't quite know what was the cause of that. There's certainly some evidence in the standards to support allowing diversification between the morbidity products specifically, and if you extend that logic further, between the other risks as well. I'll now move on to where we sort of looked more broadly than the prudential standards into insights as to how you might set the future stress reserve. The Risk Business Capital Task Force paper is perhaps the most obvious source of insight. It was referred to specifically by APRA as being a place where you might go for guidance. When using this paper, it's really important that you consider how the paradigm has moved to the new standards, new APRA standards, compared to what the Risk Business Capital Task Force was anticipating when they wrote that paper. So specifically, there's been an operational stress introduced, which wasn't envisioned when that paper was written. So some of the examples that the task force uses include an allowance for operational risk in there. And secondly, the task force paper was done assuming that we would continue with the idea that diversification would be done implicitly rather than explicitly. So all the reserves were set at a 97% level with the idea that you just add them all up and that would equate to 99.5%. What that means is that when we wrote that paper, we made all sorts of assumptions. And not all of those assumptions remain valid when you're looking at 99.5% versus 97%. And so it's really important that when you're reading it and when you're using it, you really challenge every sort of component to say, is that component still going to be valid at the 99.5 rather than 97? And one of the, a good example of that is the use of a normal distribution, which I think is quite good at 97%. I'm not so sure it's still relevant at 99.5. And there's been lots of work done in the general insurance space on, you know, translating on how difficult it is to look at the 99.5 versus something lower in this area. Speaking of general insurance, the next place we looked for insight was the general insurance area, and I think it's fair to say that general insurance is probably a lot more technical in terms of the quantitative analysis that's being done and the diversity of what they're doing. What we see in the life insurance industry at the moment is that people are sort of will have one method of calculating their margin, whereas in the general insurance industry, they'll typically try sort of a selection of methods to get different insights because they all have different properties and then set their margin based upon a wider use of information. In the life insurance industry also, we tend to be setting reserves for active lives and then we sort of adjust it or just adopt it for the IBNR. So sometimes people just adopt it and sometimes people might adjust it using some qualitative methods. In general insurance, we can see that people are actually calculating those, you know, increasingly using different approaches and different methods and identifying that they're quite different risks. What I want to talk about, however, is the framework which the General Insurance Risk Margin Task Force put together in terms of trying to get more consistency in risk margins across the general insurance industry, because they had exactly the same problem that we're having in life insurance, in that there's this wide diversity of margins due to different approaches. So the general insurance framework proposed that there was 9 steps you should go through. The first step is probably just to identify what product groups you're going to think of. So for us, we'd probably think of retail death, retail TPD, et cetera. You might even want to break it down further in the fact that you might want to separate out your consumer credit or your direct business as having different risk properties to your underwritten business. The second thing they did was they used quantitative methods to calculate the random stress margin. The next 3 steps relate to the future stress margin in life insurance. So the task force, the general insurance task force, thought about risks as being internal or external. We've thought about them as being the trend, cyclical, etc., but I don't think it makes a huge amount of difference. The key insight is that what they did is they adopted a scorecard approach to combine the qualitative and the quantitative analysis in this area, and I'm going to go through that scorecard approach on the next slide. The next step was that they considered the analysis of correlation effects, and this was done at probably quite a high level just to get a broad feel. Once they've calculated that future margin, they then consolidated their analysis. They performed additional analysis, including sensitivity, scenario testing, external benchmarking to understand are the assumptions reasonable and which ones are really sensitive, so they should worry about them more and which ones aren't, documented the approach and reviewed it. In terms of that scorecard approach, we quite like the scorecard approach. We think it creates a nice structure in which to do the quantitative and qualitative analysis. So I'm going to go through an example. The first thing you should do is have a think about what characteristics the risk has. So if you're thinking of, for example, data and analysis risk, it's got a variety of characteristics, which I've listed some of them on the slide there. If we want to take an example, you know, processes for obtaining and processing data are robust and replicable. So you can think about your different products and you can think about what your processes are like in terms of those different products and rate each product to say, this one's probably a high risk, this one's a low risk, scale of 1 to 5, say. And then you can get across all these different characteristics, you can get an idea of how risky your product is. You can then average those or weight them in some way and get an overall risk measure for the product. So it's just a way of saying, let's consider all the characteristics, make a judgment on each of them to come up with an overall idea, which has been done in a structured manner. The second component is, well, we've got this, we now have an idea of the comparative level of risk. How do I go about setting my margin based on that? And so the key thing now is to go, well, I've probably got some data for some products. I may have some data for all products, but I've definitely got data for some products. So you have a look at the products where you can have data and where you can do some analysis. You do the analysis there. And then you say, well, now that I've done that analysis and I can get an idea of what the 99.5 is, how do I need to adjust that analysis based upon some of these characteristics that I've talked about to say that what I've got may not be a fully reflective of what my risk may be in the future, because any analysis you do on historic data will only reflect the risks that you've had in the past. You've got to think about how your risks in the future might differ from those in the past. So once you've done that, you can get a risk margin for that product. Even if you've only got a risk margin for one product at this point, what you can then do is set all the others on the basis of that product by the fact that you know the comparative levels of riskiness. And one of the insights from the General Insurance Task Force is to say, don't assume it's linear. So if you've kind of got, if the margin you set was for the low product, say, low risk product, you've got low, medium and high, you can't just say, well, medium's going to be twice and high might be three times, because it's much more likely that medium might be twice and high might be five times, say, because the risk extrapolates. Some ideas of quantitative analysis that you could do. The task force suggested using a misestimation of the mean formula. There's also an idea that you could use. You could have a look at what your pessimistic best estimate assumption might look like. Bear in mind that when you set your best estimate assumption, there's sort of a range of reasonable outcomes. So have a think about what the bottom level of that or the top level of that range might look like in terms of how wrong your best estimate might be. You can also do something called hindsight analysis, which is to say, well, if I was to go back with perfect hindsight, where would I have set that assumption compared to where I actually set it? We looked at Solvency II to get an idea of, an extreme external benchmarking. Man showed you some results at the start regarding the benchmarking across the Australian industry. We thought we might have a look at the UK to see where they're at compared to where we're at. UK sets margins for mortality using two key measures usually, misestimation of the mean and trend. And you can see that we didn't have an idea of how they might correlate those, so we combined them with a zero correlation or 100% correlation. And even with the 100%, we get 18% average risk margin compared to Australia's of 19 and 26%. So what I get from that is Australia's a little bit higher, but we're definitely in the same ballpark. And it's not necessarily the case that we're too high. If you decided that the UK was right, it's not necessarily the case that we're not right as well. There's some key differences between the UK and Australia, most specifically the fact that they have a longer time horizon than we have. If you have a look at what management actions they're assuming, their management actions don't tend to be in the nature of I'm going to reprice everything in 3 years' time. They tend to be longer term in nature. They've got slightly different products and they'll have slightly different methods of calculation. So, in conclusion, our survey identified that there was a wide range of margins and the differences weren't explicable by company-specific characteristics, but instead reflected differences in interpretation of the standards, methodologies, and the level of risk implied by qualitative analysis. We've considered in our paper and discussed today some of those interpretation differences, which comes down to a lot of the time due to a prescriptive reading of the standard or a principles-based reading of the standard. We've also looked for insights as to how we can get a more robust method of setting those risk margins, looking at insights from the Risk Business Capital Task Force, the General Insurance Risk Margin Task Force, and then finally benchmarking the results of Australia against UK. Thank you.
Thank you, Violet. I now invite you to ask questions of Brian and Martin from the floor. Please set your name before you speak so that we can record it for posterity.
It's Richard Land. Thanks for the presentation. I think it was fantastic that you've analysed it into the reasons why there might be differences and given the insights rather than just say they're all different. So that's fantastic. So those key reasons for differences being interpretations, methodologies and views would, in my mind, give a reason for the Institute or APRA to provide guidance. What's your views on that?
So I guess our view is exactly the right, that unless APRA provides guidance specifically on the interpretation issues, it's very unlikely that the industry will come to a consensus.
And I should have mentioned that at the start of the presentation, that the purpose of the writing the paper was first of all to make it highlight to industry participants that there's a different views, to stimulate discussion, and then hopefully help the industry come to a consensus. And I think the way that you get to that outcome is through a task force being established. And interaction with APRA, of course.
I think a lot of the insights that we got from the general insurance, which were highlighted, were a method of, I guess, formalising the way that you'll combine the qualitative and the quantitative analysis. And I think that holds true at any percentile to say, let's put some structure around it so that we can do it within in a consistent and replicable manner rather than a bit of the guesswork that has been discussed previously. In terms of the methods used to get to the 9, 9.5 in terms of specific techniques, I think it would be fair to say that definitely you do need to use different methods at the 9, 9.5 than you do at the 75th or the 97th percentile. What I would highlight, though, is that what the life insurance industry is doing is less technical and less sophisticated than what the general insurance is doing at the 75th percentile, so just moving there would in some cases be an improvement in terms of sophistication and understanding. But as always, you do need to, I guess, think about what the assumptions are that are underlying it and whether they remain holding true at the 9, 9.5.
Fred Jorgensen. I'm just interested, for many of you will know that I'm convener of the Life Financial Reporting Subcommittee, and this is an area that we've had some discussion about when to and whether to commence work on areas about the guidance of setting risk management. I guess I'm interested in thoughts from the presenters or generally in the room of whether we feel that some work in the industry and the profession around these interpretation issues is the way to move forward, or whether we feel that, you know, that would be good, but if we're not going to reach consensus on that, whether it's something that has to be put back in APRA's court. And I guess related to that is the area of developing guidance on ways of setting risk margins, where the work in that area would be premature or be in the nature of spinning our wheels before a number of these interpretations
resolved. Do you want to take one? So I guess in the matter of the interpretation issues, the ones that we've done to date, well, the ones that we've covered in this paper, are the future stress interpretation issues. There are a number of further interpretation issues in other areas of the standards relating to the random stress, which we didn't cover in the interest of getting the paper out last night rather than next week. So I think that there would be value in doing some additional work simply so that all of the issues are teased out when we go to APRA. But I think it is an issue which ultimately APRA might need to resolve.
And there's also differences in other aspects of the calculations as well. So it's just not around the margins, it's also in other aspects as well where we see people doing different things.
I think this is where we would benefit greatly from the discussion from the floor. Like, did you agree with the observations? Did you think that if we get together and we come closer to a consensus, that might be better than being regulated to? Come on, Richard.
So to me, I think it's black and white. If we believe your analysis and your discussions with the companies, if there's differences due to interpretation, methodologies, views, I reckon it's just not appropriate to have a regulatory capital requirement where you could have four identical companies with four identical risk management strategies and you get a different regulatory capital outcome. It's a lot easier to have the guidance up front to make one change rather than say, oh yeah, we had a go first time, we got it a bit wrong, so let's raise a bit more capital or something. And likewise, when the international accounting standards come in, it would be nice to get that right first time rather than to make adjustments over time. So I reckon it would be worthwhile personally.
Mm. Any more votes for that from the room? John? And then Rob?
I want you to microphone, I'll just talk louder. John Sloak from ANZ. Look, I'd be firmly in the camp of an institute-led principle-based rather than a legislative approach. I think you end up with a better outcome. It'd be interesting at the end of today if you did a straw poll.
Yeah, will do. Rob?
Rob, sorry, sir. Yeah, but personally, I agree. I think there's a need for task force to sort of drive consistency. And I think I've probably made the same point at the last session that started it. So I don't think it's just limited to risk margins. There's other areas of interpretation as well that are being interpreted differently, even though the standards are meant to be sort of more consistent. There's still a range of certain words can be read in different ways. But as I sort of say, it's sort of wider. To drive consensus, it makes sense, particularly in this area. But we've got to remember materiality as well. Some of these margins may not have a material impact on the capital anyway, because they affect the RFA and the termination values are predominant, so therefore it's less important. And that needs to be brought into play. Also, these things are not results. We don't really know what's going to happen until with the benefit of hindsight. So we've got to realise that there's a broad range that can be applied. But that said, I still agree that there should be more consistency in how we approach this.
So 3 vote for doing the guidance threat and none to the opposite. And my personal vote would be for us to have guidance note up front as well, because I think we get a better outcome that way. Did any of the observation came as a... Duncan? Yes, you could be right there. Could be an information note, but some sort of discussion notes, information note would be helpful for the industry. I think at the moment we don't have any.
I may be a lone voice on this then, on the basis of the previous speakers, but a bugbear I've had with the information notes, it kind of says at the start of it, it recognises there's room for differences of view, that it's not intended as guidance, it might be intended to encourage some divergence of view, but it doesn't have any forms. And so if we're contemplating trying to come to something around the information mode where there's actually seemingly acknowledged or potential differences in interpretation of Ackroyd's words, I'm not sure where that gets you to. Because I can see that ultimately that's going to get you to, there are different approaches that are being out there in practice, and they're born out of different interpretations of Ackroyd standards. So the issue to my mind is to get a solid base on what a consensus around what the interpretation of those standards should be. And I'm not sure I see that as a role for the task force, the Institute, at least not yet. I think if there are material, come back to Rob's point, if there are differences of interpretation that are material in terms of outcomes to potential regulatory capital requirements, I think that's a bad outcome. But I think the onus should be on the profession working in conjunction with ACRA, but also by ACRA to actually call some of that out. Given how life's evolved with profession working with ACRA over recent years, I don't see as a profession how we can take the lead on that. And I'm not sure we should be under any illusions that presumably ACRA will also read this paper with keen interest and will see the divergence of views and will presumably do what the UK regulator did with the introduction of ICA there, and we'll go around the market and try and understand for itself what's driving these ranges that we're seeing. And maybe they'll force a consensus on this before we get to conclude views out of the task force.
There was one other point I just wanted to make that I forgot to make, was in terms of the margins that we showed on the board there, they were based on the survey results that we did in December through to February. And since then, some of those margins have changed. So this is a view of where it was 3 months ago. Since then, some companies have revised their margins and so forth. So you need to take that into consideration also when you're looking at those results.
Just in an interpretation, there are different approaches that are only actually factored into even bigger differences. So I think that there's room for both a sort of information note about the different approaches that can be used within an agreed interpretation, as well as clarifying said interpretation.
We've got room for a couple of more questions if people want to raise them.
Most people are just running the pandemic event. Some people are having an event that's worse than a pandemic. Some people basically, I think there's a three or four or five companies that are holding an event that's greater than the pandemic event specified by APRA. Probably not as high as five, but it's probably around three, I think.
Any last minute question before we close? Okay, thank you. If there's no more questions, I'd like you to join me in thanking Martin and Rylan in the usual way.